System on RadioArea.com.
Our next speaker, I'm so thrilled to have, because I think he's probably one of the most feared speakers in this country by Zionists and neocons, and he's actually one of the most sought after speakers. I had to get in the queue, so we're very honoured to have him. He's currently researching for his new book, Tinker Tailor Banker Spy. Featured on Russia Today, and he's known, European, internationally known, for his encyclopedic knowledge of politics, past and present and future. So, ladies and gentlemen, there's only one Peter Rushton.
Well, thanks very much for that introduction, Julie. I'll try to live up to it. After this week's rather grim election news across the board, I thought it was time to look at an area which proves that our movement does still have some serious potential to mobilise the support of the great British public, not necessarily in elections, but to mobilise public support in the broader sense. Now, by our movement, I don't mean the movement for Brexit. In effect, Aaron Banks, whose statements most people have probably seen in the last couple of days about the fate of UKIP and the fate of electoral politics, in effect, I think Aaron Banks is right that the coming general election next month is all about sealing the Brexit deal, which is why that election is, in the broader sense, irrelevant for our movement. Not necessarily all elections, but this particular general election, I think racial nationalist parties, it's going to be a bit of a waste of time for all of us. Good luck to anybody who's standing from any racial nationalist party, but I suspect it's going to be a bit of a waste of time for us. By our movement, I don't mean either those who are exclusively obsessed by Islam. No doubt there are many undesirable aliens in our country who happen to be Muslim. But make no mistake, this country would be facing a critical threat from immigration, a critical threat from racial demographics, a racial time bomb right now, even if the prophet had never been born.
Yes.
And there was the key word a moment ago, a dangerous word, borderline, the word that gets you into legal difficulties, the word that gets you fired from your job, the word that gets you silenced in the media, a racial time bomb. The distinguishing feature of our movement, the uniting feature of our movement, is not an obsession with constitutional minutiae, Brussels, devolution, an English Parliament, this law, that law. Because just as our immigration problem would be the same even if the prophet had never been born, our real immigration problem, the non-European immigration problem, would also be the same even if we had never joined what was once called the common market. You have to be quite elderly to remember the days when it was called the common market, but there we are. Another of these things that over time they change the nomenclature of these things, whether it's Sellafield and these various nuclear plants, or whether it's the common market becomes the European Economic Community, becomes the European Community, becomes the European Union. But even in the days when it was if we'd never had anything to do with it, if it had never existed, we would still have this racial time bomb. Because it was the demands of a different market, not the European common market, the demands of high finance capitalism and its masters, it was those demands, not the Quran, the Treaty of Rome, or any particular politically correct politician. It was those demands that piled up what Enoch Powell famously called the funeral pyre of our nation. So the The distinguishing and uniting feature of our movement, in short, is that we defend the true roots of national sovereignty. Not a particular parliament, not a particular constitution written or unwritten, the true roots of sovereignty, the cultural basis of our sovereignty, and yes, the racial basis of our nation. Over the decades, since large-scale non-white immigration to our country began at the end of the 1940s, people might be forgiven for thinking that racial nationalism, our movement in the broader sense, has become steadily less potent as a threat, steadily more marginal, steadily more fringe, to be dismissed almost as a joke. And you can see quite often the difficulty that some liberal commentators have on anti-racist websites. On the one hand, they're appealing for funds. Donate now. Rather like some people in the nationalist movement. Press the button to donate now to the anti-racist cause, because these racists are such a terrible threat. And yet the next minute, at least three quarters of their propaganda is designed to portray all racists as clowns, jokes, drunks, fools to be dismissed. They seem never quite to get their narrative right as to whether we're such a terrible threat that you must donate now to stop us, or whether we're a bunch of jokers that no sane person would want to associate with. So you might be forgiven for thinking that from that online narrative, and also from the mainstream media and academic narrative, that over time, since the late 40s, the general trend has been for racial nationalism to become steadily less potent as a threat to the liberal society. Yes, occasional eruptions, you know, Sir Oswald Mosley's last political revival with union movement at the end of the 50s and early 60s, an early version of the BNP in the early 60s, the NF from 67 through to the end of the 70s, and the BNP from the start of the 90s. But pockets of resistance, pockets isolated at particular points in time, isolated in particular parts of the country, you might be forgiven for thinking. But the mainstream view would probably be, the mainstream view is pessimistic for us, optimistic for the liberal media. The liberal media types such as those who made, I think it's still on YouTube, I remember it being filmed actually, but large parts of it being filmed, a film called The Lost Race. Yeah. The liberal media were smugly congratulating themselves that they'd seen us all off. It, funnily enough, it never got repeated, because not long after that, the BNP started to rise up again and win seats. But at that time, when that film was made, they were treating us pretty much as a joke and interviewing various people and treating us as a joke about 15 years ago. The mainstream view of those types of people who make that type of programme would be that the broad trend down the decades, you could always draw a graph of it, is towards mass acceptance of multiculturalism. That's the tide of history, and anyone who doesn't like it had better well just shut up and accept that they're losers. They're on the losing tide side of history. But you'd be very glad to hear, ladies and gentlemen, there's a but in this otherwise gloomy liberal narrative. If they were right, if that had truly been the case, if we really are the lost race, why is it? Why is it that in that same period, across those same decades, we've seen a progressive tightening of the law against so-called inciting racial hatred and various other such terms, but broadly speaking, the race laws? If racial awareness were truly some mad, outdated idea, appealing only to a fast-fading minority of elderly, crotchety Britons, why would Parliament, or rather, why would those who pay the parliamentary piper, why would they care about incitement? After all, as one Home Office internal document put it, and I'll be, for reasons that will become clear in a moment, I'll be quoting a few of these internal Home Office documents that referred to the development of race law. As one internal Home Office document put it, relating to the roots of the race law in the 1936 Public Order Act, Section 5A of that, they said, they admitted, that Section 5A constitutes an unusual provision in English law, inasmuch as it penalises a person for inciting a state of affairs which is not in itself a crime. You know, if I incite you to go out and break a window, clearly I'm inciting you to commit a crime. If I'm inciting hatred, I'm inciting an emotion, I'm inciting an opinion, that emotion or opinion is not in itself a crime. So the Home Office admit that this is an anomalous situation in English law. And they say at that point, again, for reasons that will become clear the way it developed in this one, the justification for this is that the offence is linked closely with the preservation of public order. Section 5 of the Public Order Act 1936 concerns incitement intended to provoke or likely to occasion a breach of the peace. That was how it was termed in those days. Dealing with incitement in a public place to a state of mind which is likely to result in the commission of further offences. And, of course, at this point, the Liberals have to be very careful. They say, in defending the offence against the criticism that it is an unwarranted intrusion into freedom of expression, successive governments have emphasised that it is not intended to penalise individual opinions, however offensive, perish the thought, or their expression in a restrained or moderate manner, but to penalise words or material which are of such a nature or expressed in such a way that they carry the seeds of racial violence. So that was how it started. In other words, an opinion, or rather an incitement to hold an opinion, is criminalised, even though any actual criminality flowing from this hatred would already have been a common law offence. You know, to get back to the breaking the window analogy, it wouldn't matter if I went out and broke somebody's windows on the way back to Swindon Railway Station tonight. It would have been a criminal offence, regardless of whether I did that out of racial hatred, out of personal animus against the person whose house it was, or because Julie had paid me to do it out of mercenary motives, or because I'd had a few too many beers. All of those things, it might have gone towards helping to explain to the court that it was me who did it, i.e. providing a motive. But regardless of the motive, it would still have been a criminal offence. So there was no need to have a racial incitement clause, a criminalisation of opinion. How and why did this criminalisation of opinion, as opposed to the normal common law offences that might flow from hatred, how and why did this criminalisation begin to develop? Well, I've been looking at the documentary record to try to explain how this happened. Part of the reason for doing that is because of the very dangerous way that I've perceived it developing just in the last few months. And I'll be publishing articles on this in a couple of months' time, but I thought I'd share part of the story with you today. Soon after the war, pressure began from the usual suspects, from representatives of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, in particular, and members of Parliament closely linked to them. Pressure began to introduce a criminal offence of what they termed at the time group defamation. And one of the main voices pushing for this in Parliament, it's a man called Tom Dryburgh, who'd been an influential journalist during the war, rather notorious for aspects of his private life that we won't go into because it puts you off your dinner. He also had a rather dubious past. Nobody even now seems quite to know whether he was a long-term MI5 agent or a long-term KGB agent, but he was a dodgy character in various respects, was Mr. Dryburgh, and very, very close to the usual suspects. And he, throughout the correspondence on this, you can see Dreiberg as one of the main people pushing for it. And it was to be termed group defamation. And their argument roughly ran that it can be a civil offence. You have a civil remedy as an individual if somebody defames you, either in terms of libel or in terms of slander. But that has to be an individual. It can't be a group of people. It can't be an amorphous group of people, or even a specific group by a particular religion, a particular race. Cannot say, you have defamed us as a race or religion. So they said, their argument was, that we need to have a new law. And of course, being just after the war, they were already beating the drum about the gas chambers and everything, saying it starts with group defamation and it ends with the gas chambers. Now, at that stage, the term group defamation was discussed early on in the 1940s, and they had a committee that looked at it. Now, as the Home Office put it in a later document here, this idea of group defamation didn't get anywhere. It ended up not being brought into law, and there was an interesting reason for that. They said that the idea of group defamation tends to ignore the public order consequences. So it wasn't a development of public order law. It tended to focus on the offensiveness of the views to the persons against whom they are directed. So it's two separate ways of looking at developing race law. Does it cause a public order problem? I.e. incitement of a particular mass feeling that's going to stir up a public order problem? Or is it offensive to an individual? Rather, as we heard from the previous speaker, that's become the terrible thing nowadays, you know, that you mustn't be offensive, you mustn't hurt anybody's feelings. But in the 1940s, they were a little bit worried about criminalising something just because it hurt somebody's feelings. They hadn't got quite as soft in those days as we have now. They said, in particular, they were defending the Englishman's traditional liberties, as it were. And even Labour spokesmen at the time were defending the traditional English liberties and saying that we can't really go down this group defamation route because it would be impossible to amend the law in such a way as to avoid the possibility of proscribing perfectly proper criticisms of particular groups or classes of persons. A further objection is that group defamation could not provide adequate criteria for establishing the criminality of the acts with which it was concerned. So, in other words, they're extending the law too far. And in particular, this was the crucial matter. This gets us to the thread that runs through the whole discussion of race law from that day to this. Not legal principle. Not the normal questions of justice, but questions of realpolitik. Will this law produce the right political outcome if we introduce it? And what they were worried about with group defamation is that trials on the basis of that type of law would produce the wrong political effect. It could blow up in their faces, in other words, once it came to court. Because, as the Home Office put it, from a practical point of view, the wisdom of using the criminal law in this way is it's quite telling language that they're using. Using the criminal law to obtain a particular political objective. Using the criminal law in this way is doubtful. Prosecutions for group defamation would be likely to prove controversial and result in a harmful public spectacle. If defences of justification and reasonable comment were available, as of course there would be in a libel case. Some of the topics that were discussed by the previous speaker, if things were said about somebody that were deemed to be defamatory, about their personal conduct, their financial conduct, whatever, and they took legal action, they sued over it, a possible defence would be to say, well, yes, I said that, but I said it because it's true. I said that about you because so the truth would be, quite obviously, a defence in any defamation suit, whether in a civil defamation, a civil libel suit, or in a criminal case of group defamation, logically, if they extend it to the criminal law. And, of course, they're not idiots, these people, right, discussing whether to what laws to introduce. They say, if defences of justification and reasonable comment were available, as presumably they would in justice have to be, cases would hinge on damaging arguments on the facts. And the last thing they want is a damaging argument to be brought in the courts, particularly about group defamation. So if someone were to say, picking a racial stroke religious group entirely at random, if someone were to say, the Second World War, we got tricked into the First and Second World War as a result of a conspiracy of international Jews. Perish the thought that anyone would say anything so dreadful. But if someone were to say that, and a Jewish group were to use a group defamation law and take somebody to the criminal court, under a group defamation law, the defendant would be able to say, yes, I said that, but it's true, or it's fair comment, because of X, Y, and Z. And because he was in a criminal court, that defence would then come under qualified privilege, and the press would be able to repeat what had been said in the court, and the whole thing would just get absolutely horrendous. So, ladies and gentlemen, you will not be surprised to hear that once they started to think it through, the idea of a criminal group defamation law was ditched. Because the last thing they wanted was somebody to be able to defend themselves on the basis of truth. The last thing they wanted in this area of the law was for truth to be a defence. So, they move on. They move on to Plan B. Group defamation wouldn't do. The criminalisers in their lobby groups, who were determined in some way to silence people from speaking their mind about racial matters, the criminalisers moved on to propose criminal offences based on public order. Now, this was far more promising territory, but it had to wait another 15 years or so before the traditional structures of British society, the traditional respect for law and order, the traditional assumption that normal Britons behave themselves in an orderly fashion 99% of the time. They had to wait another 15 years or so after the late 1940s, but we then move into the 1960s. Traditional, by then, those traditional structures had sufficiently crumbled, sufficiently decayed, for public disorder to become a more, in all sorts of ways, to become a more serious, pressing, and considerable problem. Now, this public order concept was based on, broadly speaking, on two things. Very broadly, on the medieval concept of seditious libel, and more specifically on the provisions of the 1936 Public Order Act. Now, seditious libel, completely different idea from either group libel or individual libel. And it's rather confusing that the term libel comes into it at all, that simply means a publication, regardless of truth, falsehood, or anything else going way back. And seditious libel, in the medieval sense, was when the king and the representatives of the king, his sheriffs up and down the country, wanted to maintain order, wanted to shut up troublemakers, wanted to keep the king's peace at all costs. And if you published something or said something in put about any idea from medieval times on that was likely to stir up trouble in any neighbourhood, that was a seditious libel, a speech or later on publication that was going to stir things up. And this, the crucial thing here is the truth in that respect didn't matter a damn. It was the fact that it was going to stir up trouble. And if the king and his sheriffs don't want you to stir up trouble, you'd better jolly well not, whether you're speaking the truth or not. Seditious libel was to shut you up. Now, when that became further codified, that ancient concept, in 1936, I think most people in this room will realise why, at the time of the 1936 Public Order Act, this was crystallised into a particular legal form. Because during the 1930s, troublemaking, as it were, was not just somebody in a particular village who was a bit of a hothead. It was a systemic problem with communists and fascists across Europe fighting each other on the streets. And various aspects of the Public Order Act affected marches, public meetings, of course, as we all know, that still affects us today, political uniforms, the potential for quasi-paramilitary drilling, all sorts of things in that Public Order Act. And it was a certain section of that was looked on from the perspective of the 50s and 60s. They looked back at the Public Order Act and thought, in the new circumstances of multiracial Britain, if we are wanting to silence people, this is the legal tradition we need to tap. Not libel, where truth is a defence, but public order, where truth is not a defence. Where it's keep the peace or else. Now, to begin with, in the 1960s, they then brought in this first race law that, drawing on that public order tradition, and to begin with, intent was the key issue. Were you intending to stir up racial hatred? And this was the basis on which the first prosecutions in the late 1960s were brought. And it became problematic. Because this was under Section 6 of the Race Relations Act 1965. It had to be proved that the accused intended his words or writings to have the effect that they did. So got rid of one problem, the idea of truth being a defence. That's gone. They've got a new problem, and that is having to prove intent. And one of the ultimate sort of liberal multiculti judges of the late 20th century, Lord Justice Scarman, Sir Leslie Scarman as he then was probably most famous for his report on the riots, of course, in the 1980s, that was bending over backwards, to be fair, to our coloured brethren. But in 1974, Scarman was wheeled out quite a few years before those riots, in 1974, to report on the disorders at Red Lion Square, Battle of Red Lion Square. And he said at that point, rather than saying, well, the problem here is that various lefty types are out to disrupt a perfectly lawful meeting, his argument was, if these evil fascists and racists were behaving perfectly lawfully, we'd better jolly well change the law to make sure that in future what they're doing won't be lawful, and we can criminalise them. So, and the key thing was to drop the intent requirement. And the government accepted that, and a couple of years later they brought in a tightened Race Relations Act where intent wasn't an issue. It's interesting, of course, that this issue of the subjective intent as against the objective nature of the words involved. Having got rid of truth being a defence, they get rid of intent being an issue, so it then becomes a question of having regard to all the circumstances. Racial hatred is likely to be stirred up. But it's still a question of stirring up racial hatred among the general public. Now, even that then becomes not tight enough. They find that still these wicked racists and fascists are finding a way to stay on the right side of the law. These spoil sports in racial nationalist movements are staying within the law. So we've got, the answer is, we've got to change the law again and make it even tighter. And they start to look, by the early 1980s, which is when some of these very latest documents to have been released from within the Home Office that I've recently photographed, when by the time they start to be published. People within the Home Office are starting to say, well, stirring up racial hatred, even that's a bit too much of a test, a bit too restrictive a legal hurdle to pass. We've got to cast the legal net even wider if we really want to shut up all discussion of race. And strangely enough, the people concerned were in a section of the Home Office, the Community Relations section of the Home Office, which was I Division of the Home Office at the time, Community Relations Department. And the chap whose name crops up throughout these documents, writing his commentaries throughout the late 1970s and 80s, was the guy in charge of this Community Relations Division, one Neville Nagler. Now, Mr. Nagler had a particular point of view on all of this, which will be obvious when you see that when he retired from the Home Office, he walked straight into a job as Chief Executive of the Board of Deputies of British Jews. You have, on the one hand, it's rather like the this year's the anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, and as many of you will know, this thing that people call the Balfour Declaration, this letter to Lord Rothschild, was a rather unusual letter in the first instance it was Lord Rothschild's representatives inside the British government who drafted a letter. It's rather like drafting a letter to yourself. We have this rather parallel situation inside the Home Office, where the Board of Deputies are making submissions as to how they would like the Race Act to go. And these submissions go to the Home Office and get knocked around. And then the guy in charge of the department in the Home Office is himself somebody who's a synagogue official who goes on to be Chief Executive of the Board of Deputies. So it's all this sort of circular Whitehall manoeuvring of people writing letters to themselves or sending memos to themselves. And surprisingly enough, they reach agreement. Mr. Nagler and co. Start to say, well, we're a little bit worried about this stirring up phrase. This phrase that we don't have to prove intent, we do have to prove that having regard to all the circumstances, racial hatred is likely to be stirred up, those famous words of the Act that many of you will have heard. And he says, problem here, the words to stir up have in certain cases allowed a defence. Shock, horror. These people are still allowed a defence. They're still finding a way to defend themselves. This is not meant to be the point. There's meant to be so tightly drawn that there's no reasonable defence you can have. In certain cases, allowed a defence that racial hatred cannot be stirred up among racialists. So you're not among the general public. You're among your own. Inside a meeting. There's a legal problem.
Yeah.
We've got to try and get around this problem. And the implication is that those already prone to racial hatred, I'm sure there's nobody of that nature here today, those already prone to racial hatred can claim to be in a continuous state of hatred which cannot be stirred up further. It can be argued that there is nothing in Section 5A which makes such a defence inherently likely to succeed, but since the courts have shown themselves prepared to acquit on this basis, you can always hear them say, how dare they? You know, the courts have shown themselves prepared to acquit. There is a case for attempting to reformulate the offence to remove this defence. Further thought would need to be given to the best way of doing so, but one solution might be to amend Section 5A to read, hatred is likely to be stirred up or reinforced or intensified, or exacerbated against any racial group. At this stage, it is recommended that consideration be given to amending Section 5A so as to preclude the defence that those already prone to racial hatred cannot be incited to racial hatred. So you could see the way they're thinking. Now, some of the provisions that are discussed in this paper did actually come into the new Public Order Act in the mid-1980s. That particular definition didn't. But remember that as early as the 1980s, they've identified this as a problem. This idea of that inciting racial hatred isn't tight enough. You can see that certain people have held this in their heads ever since. There was a little bit of a fight in the Home Office, none of it in public, of course, as to what should actually make it into what became the Public Order Act in the mid-1980s. But those people that were wanting that particular tightening I've just mentioned, that wanted to move beyond inciting racial hatred to other ideas, they kept that in their head. And you'll see in a moment what they did with that. This idea of reinforcing rather than stirring up racial hatred. But before I get on to that, there are also issues of whether a private meeting as opposed to a march. This idea that many of us will have come across as to the difference between a march and a static demonstration. The difference between a public event and a private event. All of these were tightened up a little bit in the Public Order Act. The powers that were given to the police, the power of summary arrest, etc. And one of the memos from Neville Nagler says, if I have to concede that we can't necessarily ban all private meetings, if we don't ban the private meeting, then on the other side of the coin, we shouldn't interfere too much with any counter demonstrations. So you see the subtlety of their thinking on that. If we can't tighten the law so as to ban these things legally, we will have a more tolerant attitude to Antifa demonstrations and people. Let's say it's an election meeting. Let's say Kevin Bryan is a duly nominated candidate and entitled to an election meeting. The National Front's going about its normal business, as the law intends, as election law intends, having a public election meeting. But other people turn up who haven't even got a candidate in that election, and their sole purpose, as with militant pickets or something trying to block the road, all those sorts of people, their sole purpose on that occasion is to go there to try to disrupt that meeting, to try to terrify people, to try, as Julie was saying earlier on about the meeting down in Kensington, to try to put people off from going to a perfectly lawful event and perfectly lawfully held event. Now, what Nagel's saying is, okay, if we can't ban the meeting, we'll have a fairly liberal approach to what Antifa can do. Of course, he's not inciting violence blatantly. He's too clever for that. But he's saying we're going to allow mass picketing of that event as their expression of opinion, even though their sole reason for being there is to try to prevent or disrupt a lawful assembly. And in some cases, as with an election meeting, an assembly that's not only lawful, but by extension, by implication, is a fundamental part of our democracy. You know, there's not a lot of point in people having a vote if they can't cast their vote on an informed basis. So the whole idea of public meetings down the ages to be part of the electoral process, and these people turning up to block that are solely seeking to interfere with it. But Nagler says we should allow that to happen. We shouldn't interfere with them too much. Now, at this stage, they have the Public Order Act in the mid-1980s, and their intention at that stage is to tighten things yet further and further and further. Most recently, we take a further step beyond, again, a further step of tightening, and that is with the use of the Communications Act, what was once called the Malicious Communications Act. And here is this thread that we pick up from the early 1980s. Last summer, we see a Jewish lawyer called Gideon Falter and his pro bono QCs I believe, plucking this thread from the early 1980s, in which the issue of inciting the public is no longer the issue, in which, in a way, we're going back to an element of the group libel idea. Inciting is too much of a hurdle to jump. They've got rid of intent. They've got rid of various other obstructions. They want to tighten it yet further. And they want to use the Communications Act. Because under the Communications Act, it was designed initially for people who were using the telephone. When the telephone first came in, it was designed for people using the phone to make some sort of hate call or whatever, or to use the telephone in some criminal way. And they want to extend that to the use of the internet. And this is, of course, the Alison Chablot case, which is presently coming before the courts. Starts off as a private prosecution, now picked up by the Crown Prosecution Service. And this is moving completely beyond the Race Act, nothing to do with any of the Race Acts. It's using the Communications Act, because under the Communications Act, the test is not anything to do with stirring up racial hatred, it's to do with being grossly offensive. Now, the term grossly offensive is, of course, not defined. We shall await how the court approaches that. It's partly a swing back to earlier ideas where they said, it's problematic, this issue of inciting public hatred. We don't want to have to prove inciting public hatred. On this, we only have to prove offensiveness. In this case, of course, with Alison Chablot, it's not the telephone. It's been extended to mean the internet, to mean YouTube. And it's to mean you're causing offence by uploading a video to YouTube. That case will come before the courts in mid-July. It should be an interesting case for all sorts of reasons. I'll be a witness in that case, as it happens, so I'll not give the full details as to what I might have to say in the witness box. But if you're in London, Marylebone Magistrates Court, mid-July. Now, moving towards a conclusion here. The trajectory of race law in this country fits in to a worldwide, or certainly a Europe-wide, because this is really about Europeans, of course. And they're not particularly concerned about silencing what an African tribe says about another African tribe. They're wanting to silence they're wanting to shut up Europeans. They're wanting to prevent Europeans defending their heritage. They're wanting to prevent Europeans defending their race and nation. So the British race law fits into this Europe-wide pattern, where, as one historian put it quite recently, he said the entry ticket for new countries coming out of the shadow of the Iron Curtain wanting to join the European Union, to get their entry ticket to be accepted into European civilization, people had to have a Holocaust law, a Holocaust denial law, and a Holocaust museum. And as each of these countries emerges and creates a new state, sure enough, in their capital city, they'll have a Holocaust memorial, and they'll have a law criminalising Holocaust denial. Now, of course, going back to what I said earlier on about race law, just as it's a legitimate question to ask why, if racism is some old fuddy-duddy idea that belongs to the Victorian British Empire and is no longer any sort of a threat, why do they have to have a law against inciting it, or even nowadays just expressing it, even if there's no public incitement involved? The same argument can be put in a different way about Holocaust denial law. What version of history is it? What version of science is it? What version of truth is it that requires the full weight of the criminal law to protect it? A quite extraordinary situation. And yet, right across Europe, all of these countries, so far not us, but you can see with the Alison Chablot case, you see, they don't need to have a Holocaust denial law, do they? Because if to deny the Holocaust is offensive,
grossly offensive to certain people, then you put something up on YouTube that can be deemed to be denying the Holocaust, bang, we've got you under the Communications Act. No need for a Holocaust denial law in this country if they can interpret the Communications Act in that way. All across Europe, in various forms, you have these things. You have German law, Volksverhetzung. Volksverhetzung, one of these long, compound German words, literally meaning incitement of the people. And that is putting Holocaust denial into the bracket of our type of race laws, really, in a way. That you're inciting the German masses to believe something. Whether it's true or not is not a defence, as with race law. Truth is not a defence, you're inciting people. Bang, send you to prison. In the case of Horst Mahler, an 81-year-old German lawyer and philosopher, he was sent to prison got a sentence of between 10 and 11 years. Only allowed out into the prison hospital because he was critically ill and had his lower left leg removed and was still critically ill. Allowed to spend some time on parole outside prison because he was deemed to be too ill to be in prison. But then earlier this year, they said, even though you're 81, you've got a critical terminal illness, you've got one leg, we can't be allowing you to be at liberty. You're a dangerous chap. Here's your order to come back to prison. It's about back in the third week of April. He was due to come back into prison, and I'm very pleased to report that ghastly effort by the German state to lock up this 81-year-old one-legged lawyer, this ghastly effort failed because Horst made his escape the day before he was due to be reincarcerated, and Horst is now They seek him here, they seek him there, eh? And similarly, of course, there are persistent prosecutions against a lady in her 80s who happily is in much better health, although she's a few years older than Horst, Ursula Haverbeck, constantly dragged before the courts for daring to speak the truth as she sees it. And another typical example in France, under their version of the law, the Gaiso Fabius law, which is slightly different, in that instead of talking about incitement of the masses, it talks specifically about anyone who denies, disputes the verdict of the Nuremberg tribunals, which on one interpretation would say anyone who dares to tell the truth about the Katyn massacre. Because Nuremberg, of course, insisted that the Katyn massacre had been carried out by the Germans, whereas about everybody now accepts that it was carried out by the Soviets. Because that's part of the Nuremberg judgment, on one interpretation of the Gaiso Fabius law, you would be committing a criminal offence if you said that in France. Of course, the main purpose is to do with the gas chamber stories, and the most famous, the man for whom that law was specifically defined. A rare example of a criminal law being defined primarily for one man is Professor Robert Forreson, again in his late 80s, but happily still very active, and again constantly being dragged before the courts, dragged up to Paris. Over here, recent victims of the tightening of the race acts, because among these various things I've been speaking about, of course, I'm sure most of you realise, along with the constant redefining of these offences, there's also been a constant ratcheting up of the maximum sentence and an assumption among magistrates and judges that sentences should be much harsher. And a very typical example of that being the case of Lawrence Burns at Cambridge Crown Court just last year, who received an utterly savage sentence and will be in prison for the next several years if he's not released on appeal. And most recently now, the Alison Chablow case under the Communications Act. So, the overview, 1940s, group libel. 1960s idea, Public Order Act. First Race Act. Then the removal of intent. And the Second Race Act. Then increased sentences. Then, of course, most recently, religious hatred, to try to close that little loophole where you could say you were talking about a religion rather than a race. And now this new action under malicious communications, under gross offensiveness. That, again, is a brief overview of the situation. So what should we draw from that? Well, although it's probably no consolation if you're looking at a long prison sentence, or if you're having to waste your time being dragged before the courts, having that sword hanging over your head, it's actually, in one sense, it's quite hopeful, quite optimistic for us that they're constantly having to tighten this law, because it shows that they are utterly terrified of Britons being prepared to defend their race and nation, Britons being prepared to be proud of their heritage, Britons being prepared to tell the truth about the threats to that heritage. In that hopeful situation, what do we do? Very, very briefly, touching on what was said earlier, I think the short answer is we pick our fights. Don't necessarily put all our eggs in one basket, to use the phrase that was used earlier on. Elections, I believe, do have their place. Building support, using the structures that are put in place for us for publicity, such as free leaflet drops in parliamentary elections, are tremendously obviously less useful than it used to be, because people get so many leaflets through their doors nowadays compared to a couple of decades ago. But nevertheless, building credibility, building publicity, building support, particularly on local issues. Not been involved in the BNP since 2002, and I don't know the people concerned in this in the branch I'm about to mention at all. But I know there is a branch out in Essex, in the Malden area of the BNP, that's managed to get parish councillors elected on local issues. In some cases, when the parish councils were elected there, they didn't even have BNP on the ballot paper. But they have put BNP on the ballot paper more recently in the borough elections. And they've fought on the issue of, as they put it, fighting unsustainable housing. Now, housing is one of those practical issues at the local level that we can tie into the broader narrative of race and nation. For very obvious reasons to do with overcrowding, etc., etc., and people wanting to have their families close to them, issues of community, all these issues, if you have a local campaign, if you have a local presence, you can build support on it. Parish councils, the outgoing chairman of the National Front, Dave MacDonald, was also elected to a parish council in Scotland, in Aberdeen. And this, again, helps to build credibility. In that instance, I think I'm right in saying, unlike the Malden one, he did actually have National Front on the ballot paper, didn't he, Kevin? Yeah. And got elected nevertheless to a parish council. Okay, parish councils aren't going to change the world, but it builds awareness, credibility, confidence. As do, under certain circumstances, street demonstrations, provided they're well-targeted and well-disciplined. As do cultural activities in the broadest sense. Oh, and I should also say, speaking of elections, there'll be a quick plug, both on the Heritage and Destiny website and in the magazine. Many of you will know that I produce regular analyses of what's been happening in elections and in other areas of the nationalist movement. Part of the purpose of that is so that people, when they're pursuing arguments or knocking around ideas as to what we should do, they're well armed with the facts. You know, it's almost like running a magazine like that, particularly the movement news. It's rather like an ammunition factory. You know, it's producing ammunition for people to use in arguments. And in this last election, the two interesting things for me were a character UKIP wiped out, of course, but an ex-UKIP character called Kerry Smith down in Essex, who, again, I don't know, and I'm sure wouldn't agree with on a whole load of things. But when he was first elected to Essex County Council, within months, he got himself into trouble in some ridiculous political correctness row for using forbidden words or using some sort of forbidden terminology. And he was forced out of UKIP. Too politically incorrect for UKIP. On your back. So he continued to sit as an independent. And ladies and gentlemen, I think it's rather interesting that this forbidden, politically incorrect character, while all around him, he sort of stood on the burning deck, as all around him were mown down of the official UKIP characters, right across Essex, right across Lincolnshire, right across Kent, all of the UKIP council seats defeated. And this politically incorrect character, Kerry Smith, was re-elected as an independent with more than 60% of the vote. So whatever he was doing, the people down there in Essex clearly didn't care too much about his political incorrectness. And the other one, the other seat, of course, up in our neck of the woods, up in Lancashire, they won Sharon Wilkinson's own seat in Burnley, the old BNP County Council seat in Padiham and Burnley West, I think it's called, isn't it? Again, they're inheriting, if you like, there, a politically incorrect vote. So it was rather ironic that after all these years in which UKIP has been telling us, oh, you know, we can't associate with your sort of ideas. Oh no, we'll never get anywhere with your sort of ideas. We've just got to, we've got to be colourblind, we've got to talk just about the European Union, etc. Rather ironic that there are only two victories. We're in an old BNP area, and with somebody who wasn't even standing for UKIP anymore, was standing as an independent, who'd been too politically incorrect for them. Key point, building public confidence. The public, I think, slightly disagreeing with the earlier speaker, it's not so much public stupidity, or general stupidity that's the problem, as general weakness and lack of moral courage.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's where the movement, in the broadest sense, can help people. Not only as an educational role, through cultural activities, etc., and through publications, not only in what might be termed an educational role in giving people the facts, in education and training, but in building up their moral courage, giving them some hope. And that's where a whole range of activities. We don't win this golf tournament by going round the course with just a single club. There are different circumstances you're going to encounter on a golf course. That's why you take a bag of clubs around with you. And that's why the nationalist movement also has to take a bag of clubs around. Social responsibility. Am I my brother's keeper? Yes. In this case, we jolly well are, especially when our brothers, in the broader sense, have been so softened, so infantilized, forgive me for using the sexist terminology, ladies, because I know sometimes the ladies are the most courageous people in our movement, but when men across this country have been so feminized in certain respects, that they aren't able to, they lack the courage, they lack the bottle to speak out, they lack the bottle to stand up for themselves. Post-UKIP politics, not just electorally, politics in the broadest sense, in the cultural sense, can be our politics. Despite all of the legal obstacles, despite all of the repression, despite all of the anti-fascist violence, as Oswald Mosley once put it, the spirit lives, the rest will follow. Thank you very much.